Amandla.
Interviews.
La música internacional.
Independent media.
Amandla.
Amandla, 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. Sundays on KALX Berkeley.
And welcome to this, the May 23rd, 2004 edition of Amandla. Brought to you this Sunday as we bring it to you every Sunday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. here on KALX Berkeley. This week we have an interview from the archives with Michael Schmidt of the International Campaign Against Impunity. A new selection from Enemy Combatant Radio and whatever else we choose to bring you. So stick around, you won't regret it. We'll be right back after this. With the recent and ongoing revelations about dehumanizing treatment of prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan hitting the headlines daily, many of them the result of reporting by veteran journalist Seymour Hersh, I was drawn to pull from the Amandla archives an interview that was done a couple of years back, in April of 2002. That was nearly a year before the U.S.'s most recent full-scale attack on Iraq, and it was about 6 months after the invasion of Afghanistan. At that time, Michael Schmidt had organized the International Campaign Against Impunity out of Brussels, Belgium. In conjunction with John Miller from the East Timor Action Network, a campaign known as Kissinger Watch was formed. That same year, a book called The Trial of Henry Kissinger was released, and a movie called The Trials of Henry Kissinger was also released. In early May of that same year, 2002, the current U.S. administration would reject the International Criminal Court Treaty. When asked to comment on that decision, Donald Rumsfeld stated, quote, "There's the risk the International Criminal Court could attempt to assert jurisdiction over U.S. service members as well as civilians involved in counterterrorist and other military operations, something we cannot allow." At the time, we had only an inkling of the reasons Rumsfeld would not want to allow an international criminal court to have jurisdiction over Americans involved in, quote, counterterrorist and other military operations. Now, with the scandal of Abu Ghraib and other reports out of Afghanistan, it seems abundantly clear. Looking back on this interview with Michael Schmidt of the International Campaign Against Impunity about the crimes of Henry Kissinger, we start to see that as heinous as Kissinger's crimes were, they served as a model for those that came after him. I began the interview by asking Michael why Kissinger was specifically targeted by his group at that time.
I think there are two reasons for that, why focusing on Henry Kissinger. First, I think it's important that people like Milosevic and Pinochet and others are now facing trials and, you know, charges and trials. But we believe, as Westerners, that our Western government should not remain blind to the crimes committed by its own officials. And why Kissinger then? Because Kissinger is probably the most striking case of impunity of the second half of the 20th century. I mean, I don't know of any politician who has been involved in that many conflicts and crimes.
And specifically, you've mentioned, as one of his more egregious crimes, orders made about Cambodia and Laos.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure how aware the American public is that, you know, not only Vietnam was being attacked and a war was waged in Vietnam, but also in the neighboring countries, starting during the Johnson administration, Laos and Cambodia were bombed. I mean, Laos is the most heavily bombed country on earth. The U.S. dropped more bombs on Laos than it used during the Second World War. And in the case of Cambodia, the bombardment started in 69, and Kissinger and Nixon were the brains behind that bombing. And in Cambodia, probably up to several hundred thousand people were killed due to the carpet bombings. And in Laos, the figure is not as high, but also, you know, it's really staggering to see what happened in these two countries.
When in Laos, in some ways, Kissinger's legacy lives on in the form of unexploded bombs.
Yeah, this is a huge problem, and this is kind of links nicely with current affairs. I mean, the United States used cluster bombs during 1960s and 70s to, you know, bomb these countries, and cluster bombs usually, I mean, you know, up to, I don't know, 10% don't really go off. They stay in the country as mines. They're actually a lot stronger than mines. And in Laos, in the case of Laos, between 1980 and the year 2000, 11,000 Laotians, mainly peasants, were killed due to, you know, the remnants of U.S. American cluster bombs.
11,000?
Yeah, 11,000, yeah.
Oh.
Registered deaths.
And in the case of Cambodia, not only is there the issue of what happened in the 70s when Cambodia was bombed, but there are arguments that could be made that a lot of the difficulties in Cambodia since could be attributed to the effects of that bombing.
Yeah, I think one has to distinguish between a legal and a political argument. In the case of the bombings as such clearly constitute a violation of international customary law, and that's why Kissinger should be prosecuted for that. What happened is that, you know, this had the effect of, you know, destructing the fabric of Cambodian society, and this in a way paved the way for Pol Pot and his genocidal gang to seize power in this country and to carry out a genocide. I'm not blaming, obviously, the, you know, Cambodian, the Khmer Rouge genocide on Kissinger and U.S. foreign policy, but you clearly have to see the link and the causality. And most Cambodia scholars agree that there is a direct link between the bombings and the seizure of power by Pol Pot. Then, just to, you know, just for your listeners, I mean, Pol Pot is responsible for the death of about up to 2 million Cambodians.
Right. Essentially, it's the destruction of infrastructure and human population just sort of psychologically destroyed the society, not unlike what Indonesia did to East Timor with the approval of Kissinger.
Yeah, it did. And you can say that basically the bombings drove Cambodians into the hands of the Khmer Rouge. I mean, it was easy for them to argue, you know, to rally support for their, you know, for their politics, because, you know, you could always say, you know, the U.S. are bombing us, we have to organize, and that's how the Khmer Rouge attracted so many people, because their villages were being bombed for four years.
I know you've been to the Balkans. This is sort of off of what we've talked about previously, but, you know, that sort of plays into the whole idea that I've heard stated about Milosevic, that, you know, before America started bombing in Serbia, Milosevic was fairly unpopular, but as soon as the bombs started dropping, you know, we need to band together.
I'm not sure whether he was fairly unpopular or not, but it's true that, you know, bombings of this kind do serve as a good argument for, you know, dictators of this kind to really support, yeah. But I think it's a very different case. But, yeah.
Certainly, certainly. Well, I guess we established there that based on events in Cambodia and Laos, and I guess we will also talk about Angola and Chile, and we've talked about East Timor, you know, Kissinger was a fairly despicable Secretary of State, but here and abroad, he's viewed as a great statesman. And in fact, some criticism of Kissinger, I've talked to people here directly about doing these interviews and gotten not direct, but sort of veiled accusations of anti-Semitism. Sometimes that's appropriate. I know that, you know, I've searched for some information on the internet and come up with I found a link when I was looking up the Sinai treaties to the Racial Nationalist Library. Now, these are not people that I'm interested, certainly, in allying myself with. Mm. How do you address that kind of concern?
It's indeed a very, very important issue. And, you know, I myself grew up in Germany, and I'm, in a way, still struggling with the legacy of, you know, of the German history, of the dark past. And my family has been, you know, my grandfather has been fairly sympathetic to Hitler's cause. And I guess, in part, my human rights activism is a result or reaction to this, to my family's ignorance vis-a-vis the crimes committed by Germans. And it's true that, you know, Kissinger grew up in Germany too, and he had to leave Germany, he had to flee Germany and seek refuge in the United States because his family was being persecuted. And then there is indeed, you find lots of stuff on the internet about Kissinger's crimes, and people try to link this to his identity as a Jew. Mm-hmm. And we make all efforts to denounce this kind of anti-Semitism. And, you know, people often refer to the Bilderberg Commission, which is a kind of secretive transatlantic planning body, and Kissinger has played a very important role in this organization. And they claim this is, you know, a kind of secret world government, and it's run by Jews, and that's absolutely absurd. I mean, there is no, obviously there are Jews in these organizations, but they're also, you know, Christians and atheists, and I think more importantly, there are lots of Jews who are very, very critical of Kissinger's actions. Yeah. Right. And, you know, there are lots of American Jews who are very, very critical of Henry Kissinger. For me, a very striking example of his own ambiguity towards anti-Semitism is that he worked with and for Richard Nixon, who was a staunch anti-Semite. I mean, you can read what Nixon has said about American Jews. It's appalling. It's really appalling.
That's very interesting in the context of when it serves his convenience, he certainly adopts the identity full force in accusations of say, Christopher Hitchens. You mentioned earlier that he accused Hitchens of being a Holocaust denier?
Yeah, he did, because Hitchens, as many American liberals, defends the right of anybody to publish, you know. Mm-hmm. So Kissinger said, he's a Holocaust denier, and then Hitchens threatened to sue him, you know, to file a libel suit, and Kissinger had to withdraw to apologize for his comments.
Something he's had to apologize not just for comments, but actions more and more these days, it seems.
Yeah.
Well, we're here talking with Michael Schmidt of the International Campaign Against Impunity. You're listening to KALX Berkeley, the Mandela program. This is the second part of a two-part series. Previously, we talked to John Miller of the East Timor Action Network about Kissinger's role in the destabilization of East Timor. Now we're talking to Michael Schmidt, who gives us a bit of a broader perspective on things. Again, when we talked earlier, you mentioned that Christopher Hitchens really isn't the only person writing on this. He's perhaps the most recent. But you mentioned William Shawcross and Seymour Hersh, who have exposed some of Kissinger's crimes. But that was like the late 70s, early 80s. Why has it, why has there been so little exposure to this man as a criminal?
The problem for researchers and campaigners is often that very important documents are declassified and you don't have access to them. What happened in the Kissinger case is that over the last two or three years, various U.S. government documents were declassified, which prove what others have already maintained before. I mean, people like Hirsch and Shawcross already did great work and exposed some of his crimes. But now, for example, last year, documents were declassified, which proved that he gave green light to the genocidal intervention of General Suharto in East Timor. And the same applies to Chile, the coup d'etat in Chile, and the rise to power of General Pinochet and Kissinger's role in that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting. We talked about this a little bit with John last week as well, that this declassification of documents in America may come to an end with some of the legislation being currently proposed. But I know that's not necessarily in your purview.
No, but it's also, obviously, I share your concerns. I think you should, I mean, the American public should be very vigilant and fight for the right to access to these kind of documents. I mean, you have a Freedom of Information Act, and you should insist on your right to read these documents, also in the future.
Absolutely. Kissinger left the government with the Ford administration, but he hasn't really stopped having influence. Some of that has occurred through his role as a consultant, or through his consulting work with corporations like the Freeport Corporation in Indonesia, which may shed some light on East Timor as well.
Yeah. In 1982, Kissinger set up, with some former colleagues, he set up a political consultancy with offices in New York and Washington. It's called Kissinger Associates. And in the case of Freeport, which is a New Orleans-based mining company, which runs the biggest mine in the world in Indonesia, he's been a paid consultant for many years, and I think his company receives about $200,000 per year for advising the company. And this company is a notorious company. I mean, they have been accused of having committed not only human rights violations, but also environmental crimes. Yeah? And it's clear to many that they have collaborated with the military regime in Indonesia, which Kissinger had supported as Secretary of State before. I think that's a very important case, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that may point to some degree to his continued involvement with policies towards East Timor, even after leaving office.
Yeah. He's also been appointed advisor to the Indonesian government a few years ago.
Mm.
Yeah. And the only thing, I mean, he said is his main advice, his key advice was don't touch Freeport.
I see. Well, he's also served as an advisor for UNICAL, which, I mean, conspiracy theorists certainly on the left would point to as having something to do with things in Afghanistan.
I would always ask people to be careful with conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the case of UNICAL, I think it's quite clear that they have played an important role in Afghanistan. And since 1995, the company has tried to negotiate with various governments in Afghanistan. And because they want to, and probably will, construct a pipeline through Afghanistan. And amongst the advisors to UNICAL are the current Prime Minister of Afghanistan and the new U.S. Special Envoy to Kabul. But also Kissinger's name pops up, and he was advising UNICAL in 95, 96, because he's got excellent links to the Tajikistan government.
Mm.
It's really an amazing story, his life as a political consultant. I also would like to mention, I think the I just recently came across a congressional report from 92 where a congressman, he's called Henry Gonzalez, questions Kissinger's role in the Iraq conflict. And in the late 1980s, an Italian bank provided loans to a government of Saddam Hussein. And at that time, Kissinger was a member of BNL's, that's this Italian bank, International Advisory Board. And that's an important case, and I couldn't find anything after 92, so I'm really interested in learning whether this was followed up, and if your listeners know anything about this case of, you know, the Iraq affair, if you want, then please let me know.
Certainly. It just seems the more we're talking, he has his finger in pies all over the place, doesn't he?
Yeah. That's really a phenomenon. That's really amazing.
One of the things that has really impressed me in researching this, and I'm, you know, sort of coming to this fairly new, has been Kissinger's duplicity. He's pretty much a pathological liar, from what I've been able to see. In Seymour Hersh's book, Price of Power, Hersh points to a plan wherein Kissinger sabotaged an Egyptian peace plan, which was brokered by then Secretary of State William Rogers, so that he could later offer a similar plan. Much as earlier, he had been revealed to have undermined efforts by the Johnson administration to broker a peace deal in Vietnam so as to help Nixon get into, or ostensibly help Nixon get into office.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. I think the term pathological liar is a very appropriate one. In the mainstream media, up to recently, Kissinger has been depicted as an honorable and you know, credible wise man of international affairs, if you want. But there has also been a significant change over the last few months. I mean, he had to admit to New York Times journalists that in his memoirs he was misleading, if not lying. And in a recent article published 2 weeks ago in the New York Times, it was stated clearly that he asked the CIA to rewrite documents in order to justify the African and American invasion of or intervention in Angola.
How will you broaden the scope of the international campaign against impunity? Because certainly Kissinger is not the only person who has committed crimes with impunity.
Yeah, that's a very important question. What we'll be trying to do in the next few months is we will be speaking and, you know, consulting various human rights organizations and individuals to see whether we can transform ICAI into a proper and sustainable campaign against the impunity of high-ranking public officials, as well as companies accused of war crimes, crimes against humanity, torture, and genocide. And, for example, we have already received a request from a lecturer from Australia, and he asked us, why not Suharto Watch? And I think that's a good point. The problem is that we currently only have limited resources, financial and human resources. Mm-hmm. But if people are interested in working with us, and I think we could be able to develop a proper long-term campaign focusing on the crimes of public officials as well as companies.
Do you have any last thoughts, Michael,
yeah,
before we go?
Yeah, I do. I mean, although we currently concentrate our efforts on Kissinger as the most striking case, it's clear that he's not the only U.S. policymaker who has endorsed or committed war crimes. Some U.S. human rights activists posed the question, isn't the time ripe for a U.S. some sort of U.S. truth commission to establish the hidden facts of the history of U.S. foreign policy, and in this way prepare the American public through consciousness raising for possible trials of some more of its former leaders? I personally would urge the American public to be very vigilant for the foreign policy activities of the current administration, and also not to forget the past crimes committed on behalf of the American people.
America, by being sort of the biggest kid on the block, has managed to escape punishment, certainly for Kissinger, but hopefully as people become more aware about some of these things, that may change.
And that was a rerun of an Amandla interview from April of 2002 with Mike Schmidt from the International Campaign Against Impunity. Funny to see how much of this is so much more relevant now than maybe it was about 2 years ago. The book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger by Christopher Hitchens, no favorite of mine, is currently available in paperback, and The Trials of Henry Kissinger can be rented at your local video store. The website for the International Campaign Against Impunity is www.icai-online.org. That's icai-online.org.
There is blood on my face, there is crust in my eye, there is no one in the place, but no one said goodbye. This is how I start another day in my kingdom. There is hate in my heart. This is how my day starts. There is blood on my hands from the murder of a man. This is how I start another day in my kingdom. And where is my queen? She's as gone as can be. a fine looking lady, and she liked to go down on me, and I liked to go down on her too. On good times there was Raj, and here you look and see, all there is me. This is how I start another day in my kingdom. This is how I start another day in my kingdom. There are good times to be had, insane's really bad. The Lord and I agree, it's not too off to be what we are, as long as we're royalty. You fucking what's to do? It's not your kingdom too.
You're listening to a mandala on KALX Berkeley. I just wanted to take this moment to announce to our listeners that we have a new website for Amandala. It is at www.undemocratic.us/Amandala. That's Amandla. And you can access archives of previous shows there, news items from the shows, hopefully will be up there soon, announcements of upcoming shows, and so much more. So check it out at www.undemocratic.us/Amandla. And one of the things you'll find there is that next week we plan to have the Berklee College Republicans, as well as Michael Starve will be back for one of his monthly rants. So you won't want to miss that. And speaking of monthly rants, I have ready to go here our twice monthly contribution from the good folks at Enemy Combatant Radio. This week they bring us a story about the Fast for Education camped out in downtown Oakland, and I believe the latest from Palestine. I bring this to you every second and fourth Sunday of the month, Enemy Combatant Radio.
Everybody knows that all the people don't have liberties. All the people don't have freedom, all the people don't have justice, and all the people don't have power, so that means none of us do.
Our generation is going to be recruited to fight these endless wars.
We will throw our bodies into the machine.
When you terrorize some of us, you terrorize every single one of us.
Tell them to turn off CNN. Tell them to turn off Fox News. The war is not in Iraq. It's on my block.
Ningún ser humano es ilegal.
I will put my body on the line every single day. until this war comes to an end.
We must keep resisting, keep fighting, and never give up.
It is the business of the future to be dangerous.
Indie Bay presents Enemy Combatant Radio every other Sunday on Calex's Amandla at 5:30 p.m.
A group of seven students, teachers, and activists in Oakland, California, enter their second week of a hunger strike today, demanding economic and racial equity for education. Jessica Vasquez is in her third year at the University of California at Berkeley. She says she is fasting for many reasons.
Because I blame the educational system that exists today as to why there's so many students dropping out, working at McDonald's, getting pregnant at a very young age, or going to prison, or even dying. When I ask students what they want to be when they grow up, they just say that they want to be alive.
Among other things, the fasters are demanding that California return $2 billion to the funds for public schools and that suburban and urban schools are funded equally. Fasters are also asking that supporters contact the governor's office, who has not yet acknowledged the strikers or their demands. Peggy Marshburn is the communications director of the Contra Costa County Office of Education. She agrees that school funding has been a problem in the state.
School funding in the state of California has been a band-aided system. We've had a number of issues for the past 30 years that have made dramatic changes in the way school districts are funded. And until we reform the entire system, there's not going to be equity for anyone.
Education activists are angered by the fact that California is first in the nation in state prison spending, but 40th in the nation in state education spending. Israel Arros is a teacher at the Urban Promise Academy in Oakland, California, and is participating in the Fast for Education.
You have lots of money being invested in prisons, you know, 5 to 10 times the amount that we invest in our children. While that is going on, you have sports programs, libraries being taken away.
Emily Hobson, who is a research associate with Californians for Justice, agrees. In addition, she says that students are often tracked away from college by the military's aggressive $2 billion per year recruiting budget.
We have students coming in who really would like to go to college, but their schools don't have enough courses to allow them to prepare for college, or they don't have enough counselors to tell them what they need to do to prepare. What they do have instead is a ROTC program that will prepare them to go into the military.
Education advocates are concerned about the conditions in which students attend classes. Emily Hobson from Californians for Justice says that the problem is not just that there are rundown school facilities. She says it's also an issue of who attends these broken schools.
We have schools where students go to school with cockroaches. They don't have credentialed teachers. They have long-term substitutes instead, where ceiling tiles are falling off the ceiling. The bathrooms don't work. And then we have other schools, you know, just across town where students have plenty of college access programs, they have excellent facilities, they have fully credentialed teachers, and we're saying that all students should have access to those kinds of schools, including students of color, low-income students, immigrant students, English learners. Everyone has the right to a high-quality education.
On this 50th anniversary of the passage of Brown versus the Board of Education, teachers and students alike say that this is particularly troubling. Wendy Gonzalez is a teacher in West Contra Costa County. She is one of the seven individuals participating in the Fast for Education.
50 years later, I still feel that we're separate and unequal. The people of color, they're the ones that are getting the basic education. The science books that I have in my classroom from 1985. So our schools are still separate and unequal. If you look at the test scores, it's not that the kids are smarter, it's they're getting less resources.
The fasters say they will continue their hunger strike until their demands are met, or for as long as their bodies can manage. For Enemy Combatant Radio on KALX's Amandla, I'm Sarah Olson.
And that was Enemy Combatant Radio for this Sunday right here on Amandla, brought to you every Sunday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. Enemy Combatant Radio comes on the second and fourth Sundays of every month. Apologies we weren't able to get the Palestine piece in time this week. So maybe we'll have, since next week's the fifth Sunday, we can put that piece in next week. So anyway, that was Enemy Combatant Radio with the Fast for Education people. Thanks so much for that. And yeah, on to more things. You know, this week, I'm sure you've heard that House Democratic leader and San Francisco Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi has stated what many have wished a Democrat would say for quite some time. She called the president incompetent. Ooh. In fact, if I may quote her, she said, "Bush is an incompetent leader. In fact, he's not a leader. He's a person who has no judgment, no experience, and no knowledge of the subjects that he has to decide upon." Bravo, Ms. Pelosi. And I might say, in general, Nancy has shown a suitable, if fairly quiet, disdain for Republican policy during her tenure as House Minority Leader. But it does still shock me that this statement should make so much news. Why on earth aren't there more Democrats saying the same thing, and why on earth do Republicans feel emboldened to respond by claiming that she is somehow putting our troops in harm's way, just because she criticizes the actions of a reckless president? Well, perhaps it's because her fellow Democrats are so heavily immersed in the politics of the inside-the-beltway crowd that they have lost all sense of right and wrong, and truth, and fiction. In this upcoming excerpt from Alexander Coburn's CD entitled Beating the Devil, The Incendiary Rants of Alexander Coburn, Coburn recounts for us the Democrats' handling of the confirmation of none other than John Ashcroft for Attorney General. From the position of Attorney General, Ashcroft has implemented the Patriot Act in all of its incarnations, and as Attorney General, Ashcroft is spending millions of dollars to bring anti-obscenity cases to courthouses for the first time nationwide in 10 years. He's also prosecuting vendors of drug paraphernalia, such as the famous case of Tommy Chong, of Cheech and Chong fame. Keep in mind, these arrests are not for possession or dealing of drugs, just the paraphernalia, like pipes and rolling papers and the like. Anyway, here is Alexander Coburn from this CD available from AK Press entitled Beating the Devil. The track, Liberals for Ashcroft.
The Democrats on the Hill won't talk to Nader now. They wouldn't let him testify against Ashcroft. They said, "You spoilt it all for us." Meanwhile, what do? They let in Ashcroft. They could have stopped Ashcroft. Have you been following the confirmation procedures? Here's Ashcroft, an absolutely blatant racist. Absolutely obvious raving racist from Missouri. And every senator gets up on his feet and says, "The one thing I can say about John Ashcroft is he's not a racist." Well, he is a racist. And then Feingold. Feingold says, "A president has a right to pick his cabinet." Feingold is meant to be a liberal Democrat from the state of Wisconsin. How far could the president go? Supposing George Bush had picked David Duke to be Attorney General. Would Feingold have said, "Duke, he has a right to pick David Duke"? Where would he stop? They could have stopped Ashcroft. The votes made it clear, 52-44, they could have sustained a filibuster. If it had been the other way around, by the way, if there had been the Republicans trying to stop people, don't you think it would have happened? Everything that's happened since the election has confirmed the absolute rightness of the basic Nader position, or the Green position, or the anti-state position, that this process is an absolute sham. It's a sham at the procedural ritual level, i.e. these confirmation hearings. What happens? Suddenly we get Norton. Norton is nominated to be Secretary of the Interior. Norton comes out of the school of Watt. James Watt, the greatest fundraiser in the history of the environmental movement. Right? Remember Watt? You only had to put a photograph of Watt up on the wall and you immediately got $100,000 going to the Sierra Club. Like that. They want those people in. The Democrats want Ashcroft to be in the Department of Justice. They want Norton to be in the Interior Department. They don't want to beat him. They want to coast along raising money on him, saying, do you want to save the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve? Send a dime. Send $10. Send $100. Do you want to be revved up and ready to vote in 2002 against fascism? And buy a copy of The Nation while you're at it. Vote for Ashcroft. I mean, there's Ashcroft. At that level, it's a complete fraud. Absolute fraud, as the parting moments of the Clinton administration, which I described in partial detail at the start, would indicate. There's been no real serious opposition to any of George Bush's nominees. A little fuss over Ashcroft. Meanwhile, real monsters are going through. Tommy Thompson of Wisconsin, four-term governor of Wisconsin, one of the most vicious welfare reforms in the country. Not a vote against him, I don't think. Not one. Norton, what? A handful of votes against. Veneman from California. Never was there such a bipartisan chorus of applause for Ann Veneman, the Secretary of Agriculture. Democrats fell over themselves praising Ann Veneman. Who is Ann Veneman? She's the former Secretary of Agriculture in the great state of California. Unless you're Rose Byrd, who was Jerry Brown's Secretary of Agriculture, and was a great Secretary of Agriculture, what are you if you're the Ag Secretary? You're the pawn and tool of the big ag interests. Who is Ann Veneman? She briefly represented Monsanto and Calgene in biotech. The only thing you can say about Ann Veneman is she's completely indistinguishable from her predecessor, Dan Glickman. How many of you react to the name Glickman? A lot of clicks in it, but he was the Democrat Secretary of Agriculture. There is absolutely no difference. In the dark, you couldn't tell them apart at all.
So I'm not going to try and go off on a tangent about Ann Veneman. I'm sure mad cow disease somehow works into talking about her, and, well, that's been talked about quite a bit already. So let's just praise Nancy Pelosi for her criticisms of Bush and demand that her colleagues speak as candidly, lest they appear to be complicit in the trespasses of this horribly incompetent and stolen presidency. Anyway, speaking of Ashcroft, it's interesting to note counterculture icon Tommy Chong was one of those charged by Ashcroft for his part in financing and promoting Chong Glass / Nice Dreams, a company started by his son Paris. Chong agreed to plead guilty to one count of conspiracy to distribute drug paraphernalia in exchange for non-prosecution of his wife and his son. While most of the approximately 55 individuals who were charged during this sweep were sentenced to fines and home detentions, Tommy Chong was sentenced to 9 months in federal prison, forfeiture of $103,000, and a year of probation. While the Department of Justice denied that Chong was treated any differently from any other defendants, many felt that he was made an example of by the government. It's interesting as well to note that in 1992, John Ashcroft's 25-year-old nephew, Alex Ashcroft, and his brother, Adam Ashcroft, were arrested and charged with production and possession of marijuana. A raid uncovered 60 marijuana plants in a basement crawl space with lighting and irrigation and a security system. And while the production of more than 50 plants usually results in a federal charge and mandatory jail time, Alex Ashcroft was prosecuted on a state charge, not a federal charge, and received 3 years of probation and 100 hours of community service. His housemate, Kevin Sheely, was not convicted, and he was also involved, and his record was sealed. Adam Ashcroft, who did not live in the house, was never prosecuted. while Alex Ashcroft tested positive for marijuana in his first probation-mandated drug test, no further actions were taken against him. Alex and Adam's parents have denied that the young men received a lenient treatment as a result of their connection to Ashcroft, who was then governor of Missouri. So let's take a look here. Tommy Chong, 9 months in a federal prison and a $103,000 fine with a year of probation. Alex Ashcroft, 3 years of probation, no jail time. And Alex Ashcroft actually was dealing in marijuana, which is supposed to be, I would think, more illegal than a pipe to smoke it in. Anyway, with that in mind, let's listen to a little piece of Tommy Chong, or Cheech and Chong.
Okay, try it now, man.
Okay. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3,
hey,
testing.
Man, don't test it, man. That's why the mic's not working, because you're spitting all over it. Come on, now. Don't spit, man. Just start. Okay, just a minute. Let me see if it's on.
Well, what do you want me to say?
Okay, we're on. Go. Oh,
okay. Hi, this is Dorm Radio, D-O-R-M, broadcasting live from the basement of the science building. Great. Okay, we want to say hi to all the techies over in Einstein Dorm. Will you shut up with that? And all the security guards and the guys playing poker down in the basement and all to the ground. Will you quit that?
Sound effects, man. Oh. Go ahead, keep going.
Okay, so we're going to be here all night playing the kind of music you want to hear. We're going to have your favorite requests and everything. So just, if you want to have a request, just call up or just come down here to the basement of the science building. We'll play any kind of music that you want.
Okay, play this tune, man. Play it.
We're not playing the Grateful Dead again.
Come on, man. Play it.
Let's play something from this century.
Just play this one cut, man.
We played that last week.
Okay. Here. Play this one, man. That's a new one.
What is this? Songs to fart by? What fraternity wanted that? Hey, forget it. We're not playing any of that music.
Okay, go to commercial. Go to commercial.
Okay. Do you need... Will you shut up? Do you need a Simmons drum with all 7 modules? Simmons SDS-5 brain operating...
Hold it, man. You're shorting it out again. Can you read this thing without spitting?
Okay, let me try. Shelly Scott, professional drummer, singer, arranger, and programmer.
Oh, never mind that commercial, man. You're spitting all over the place. Here, read this one.
Oh, okay. Hi, dudes. Are you lonely? Well, learn the joys of rubber clothing. Neither girls and excessively hairy men need not apply. Where'd you get this? Oh, shut up, spaz.
Okay, read this other one, man.
All right. Wait. Lonely. Alternatives is a dating service that specializes in younger man, older woman relationships. For details, call 285. What is that?
Nah. Your date's here, man.
Oh, get out of here, you spaz.
Okay, music. Play music.
Well, what are we going to play? Okay. Well, here's the number one requested song on the campus radio today called... What's it called? Well, where's the album cover?
I'm not home right now.
I know you're never home. There's nobody home.
That's
in your
the name
brain.
Of the tune, idiot.
Oh, the name of the tune is called...
I'm dedicated to Mikey. To Mikey.
I'm not home right now, idiot. Okay, roll them.
Ali, sabah al-khair, sabah al-noor, Nadi al-Aslam, Mikey, Mike. ما يطلبه الأطفال
Right now you're listening to a compilation called I Remember Syria by Mark Gergis from Monopause. This is Amandla on KALX Berkeley 90.7 FM, brought to you every Sunday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. Tune in next week when we have Berkeley College Republicans and Michael Starve.
Let me.
نادي الأطفال.
أهلا بكم في نادي الأطفال.
العلم نور والجهل ظلام. شكرا. وأخيرا مع الصديقة راما كمال الدين في هذه المساهمة وهي من الشعر. تبسم القمر وشع بالصور Focus. Prepared and presented by Juhayna Hafez. The march of women's liberation in Syria was accelerated under the historical leadership of President Hafez al-Assad, who considered the growing of women's role in the country as an evidence for national health. During his time, restrictions that limited women's contribution to the public life were lifted. That era was characterized with women's participation in all civil life activities, even the military life. Chances of education, work, and training were made available for women, and many important gains were realized for the Syrian woman. Admit, as Syrian women, that the level of equality we had reached in the society is quite high. This is due to the progressive outlook of the great late leader, President Hafez al-Assad, who used every occasion since the dawn of the glorious correctionist movement, led on the 16th of November 1970, in order to stress the need of women's equality. He left no speech of his in which he did not voice support for women's position. We, as Syrian women, admit that had it not been for the late leader, President Hafez al-Assad, Syrian women wouldn't have reached the positions of leadership they reached. President Leader al-Assad laid down firm bases in dealing with the women's issue to push women forward and left no occasion in which he did not affirm the progressive role of women and the need to change the society's look to women's traditional role. The great late leader, President Hafez al-Assad, has given the issue of women's liberation much of his thought, time, and effort until women were able to get gains that they in no other country of the world could achieve.
And that was a track from a CD here in the station called I Remember Syria, a collection of interviews and music and radio broadcasts and all sorts of stuff by Mark Gerges of Monopause from two visits to Syria. That track called Arab Women in Focus. All right, I just want to thank everyone who contributed to this week's show. Enemy Combatant Radio, brought to you the second and fourth Sundays of every month. Mike Schmidt from the International Campaign Against Impunity, their website icai-online.org. If you want to find out more, reminder, we've got a new website, www.undemocratic.us/Amandla. Check it out. You can find out about the Berklee College Republicans and Michael Starve coming at you next week from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. on Sunday, as Amandla always does here on KALX Berklee. Thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you later. Now time for Matthew Africa.